Samuel chapter 30, would you? First Samuel chapter 30. Last night, I tweeted, maybe we'll finish 1 Samuel this week. What do you think the odds are? Turns out, the odds aren't good. But they're really good that we'll finish next week. We'll see. But today we're going to do 1 Samuel chapter 30 is what we're going to look at. Last week, I was very thankful to Jeremy for sharing with us. Let me first get sort of a running start at this, if you will, because here we are nearing the end of the chapter, and it's real easy, you know, after many weeks, really, of going through 1 Samuel, to kind of lose track of where we've been, what the big picture is, what's the story here, what's going on. And so if you remember when we first started 1 Samuel, we were coming out of the book of Judges, and Israel, God's people, was in absolute disarray. They were a people who were doing their own thing. They weren't paying any attention to God. They weren't being led by God. They didn't care. I mean, they were just kind of a mess. And so then God raises up this new prophet and priest in Samuel. The priesthood in Israel was in disarray at that time. And so Samuel is raised up by God and trained in these priestly ways. And he becomes a mouthpiece for God for many, many years after that. But the people rejected the Lord's leadership in Samuel. Remember, Israel was supposed to be led and governed by God. And then God would have his prophets that are speaking the word out, but they were never intended to have a government in the same sense that we see government in the world around us or in the world at that time. But Israel was less interested in being different than the world, which is what God had designed them to be. They were going to be completely different than the rest of the world. And God was going to bless them and use them to bless others. And they said, no, we would rather be like the world. And they rejected God's leadership and said, we want our own king. And so God says, all right, then we'll give them a king. And so Saul is raised up. The problem is that Saul is more interested in establishing and ruling over his own kingdom than he is God's kingdom. And so it doesn't take that long before Saul starts to go astray. He's not leading the people of Israel in courage, trusting God. That's why he's shying away from Goliath, and he's not going and pursuing a lot of the military battles that he's supposed to undertake. He's afraid. He's not trusting on the Lord. He's building his own kingdom. He's doing his own thing. And so it's not long before God rejects his leadership as king, and then Samuel is sent to the house of Jesse, where the youngest son there, David, is then anointed as the next king. David, the smallest of the group, the youngest of this family, who is a shepherd at the time, is anointed as the next king. And so the Lord, through the victory over Goliath and some other circumstances, brings David into the castle, or into the palace, or into the kingdom, I should say. And he's serving underneath Saul at the time. And it's not long before David, as the Lord is raising David up, jealousy begins to develop between Saul and David, to the point that Saul tries to kill David multiple times. And so now David is on the run. And through different circumstances, he's got a band of followers, a few hundred men, and they're living in caves, and they're living in even Palestinian territory. They're going into, Philistinian territory, going over even into Goliath's hometown in Gath, seeking refuge in places that really he ought not seek. And they're kind of living as an army that's going around really plundering to a certain extent before they take over this town. They're given, if you will, the town of Ziklag. Ziklag is there in southern, what we would call Israel proper, but it's in the territory of Judah. And that becomes kind of David's home base at this time. Now, Saul is still doing his thing, but it's just spiraling. It's getting worse and worse. If you guys know, the last time we were together, we looked at how Saul ends up actually going to a witch to get some sort of idea on what he's to do and trying to conjure up the spirit of Samuel after Samuel's death. There's just a complete mess going on, and that's where we are right now. David is not yet in the throne. It's been promised, but he's going through difficulty. And as Pastor Jeremy shared with you guys so well last week, he talked about discouragement and the discouragement that David and his men go through in 1 Samuel chapter 29. And I've gotten so much feedback from people from the time spent with praying for one another and in that teaching last week. How many of you were blessed just by the word that was shared and ministered to last week? Such an encouraging word to see how it is that we're to deal with discouragement. And it sounds like many of you went home encouraged even after that. So on the heels of that, then I have a question for you. What if it gets worse? Like, we want Jeremy back. but let's be for real for just a minute. What if you're in discouragement? There's difficulty, hardship, all these things, and you go to the Lord. And the Lord's there, and the Lord comforts you and provides all those things, but the circumstances around you in life actually get worse. What does that do? Where does that leave you? That's where we are today. Let's look at verse 1. It says, now when David and his men came to Ziklag, traveling back home to their city, Ziklag, on the third day, the Amalekites had made raid against the Negev and against Ziklag. And they had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, but carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Then David and the people who were with them raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two wives had also been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all of the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. And we'll pause right there. So after this lesson in discouragement and everything that he's going through, we find out that David gets home, and as bad as things have been for him, as difficult as everything has been, it's going to get exponentially worse. In fact, the worst that David had been through hadn't even happened yet by a mile. And he comes home to Ziklag, and he's lost everything. Everything. City gone. Home gone. Possessions gone. Family gone. He's lost everything. Not just him, but all of his men. It is gone when he gets back. I mean, it's that classic, right when you think you've hit rock bottom, get ready. But this is a drop no one could have anticipated, right? I mean, this is like a when it rains, it pours times 10 to come home and find this is what's going on. I mean, what if it gets worse? What if you're seeking God? What if you're doing this and it gets worse? You know, you guys have heard me say this before. My favorite phrase to bash with a hammer into a million pieces is, God won't give you more than you can handle. I despise that phrase because it's not biblical. And everyone throws it around. It's on a million Christian Hallmark cards, so to speak. And everyone throws that around. No, it's okay. God won't give you more than you can handle. Say that to David right now. David, it's okay. I know you lost everything. Your family, your kingdom. And not only has he lost everything, by the way, now his own men are rejecting him. And now they want to stone him. His own men now have turned against him and all this. Like, he's not already hurting enough. And they say, David, it's okay, man. God's not going to give you more than you can handle. This is more than I could handle. I mean, how many would agree with me? This is more than you could handle if you were in this position. Yes, it's more than you can handle, and that's the point. We were never intended to just buck up and carry all of this stuff on our own. And see, this is a major, like, theological danger that we hammer here a lot, but we have to understand this. Because so many people would even, there's even some that would say, look, this is just the consequences of David being outside of God's territory. He's not in God's land. He's not where God would have him to be. And this is just the inevitable consequences and all that. And that's a bad way of looking at it, because Jesus was in Jerusalem and they killed him. I mean, first of all, to think that now because David is outside of the proper, if you will, controlled territory of Israel, first of all, that's false. Because he is within the boundaries of the land that God gave to Joshua and to Moses. Second of all, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Where can I go that I'm away from your presence? It's not a territorial thing where David's like, if I was just near God, this wouldn't have happened. He's near God, and yet this happens. And then also, the book of Matthew says in Matthew 5:45, for he makes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. And in Matthew chapter 7, Jesus tells a story between a wise man and a foolish man. A wise man, it says, is the man who hears Jesus' words and does them. We would call them a disciple, a follower, a Christian. And then you have the foolish man who does not hear the words, does not do those things. We would call them a unregenerate, a non-believer, a non-Christian. And there's something in Jesus' story about these two men that they have totally in common. They both get hammered by a storm. They both get hammered by a storm. And any theology that does not equip the followers of that theology with a proper understanding on suffering, on difficulty, on tragedy, you will leave your people horribly unequipped to live the life that God has called all of us to live. It's just plain hard because we live in a fallen world, so stuff falls, stuff breaks, stuff is difficult, tragedy comes. And to think that by moving into this realm that we call Christianity then somehow keeps us outside of that bubble, and that is a devastating theology to pile up on people, because then when things keep getting worse and keep getting worse, then what are you left with? Either I'm going to turn and run, God's not real, or I can't hack it, or whatever the case may be. You are leaving people completely unprepared when we preach a Christianity that does not include a proper understanding of suffering. In particular, the understanding that Jesus says, in this world you will have trouble. And the reason is, remember, what we're looking at, and we're going to see this again towards the end. This isn't just like a battle between David and the Amalekites or something. This is like a war between God and Satan. Like, there's a real battle between two kingdoms going on. And when we step out and choose to follow Jesus, to be used by Jesus, we have now joined the invading army in a world that is ruled by Satan. And so we can't expect that it's just going to go swimmingly all the time. And so we have to understand, we have to focus regularly and understand the place suffering has in our Christian walk, because otherwise it leads to horrible discouragement when things go bad. I bet if we really just took a poll, while you may have been encouraged last week, and that's all good, I'm not undoing anything that Jeremy said, it's a very good chance that there's several of you in this place that the circumstances didn't necessarily go away right away and maybe got worse. And so then what are you left with? Well, all that stuff Jeremy said last night that makes you feel good and all, but only lasts as long as church lasts. Didn't help me any on Thursday morning. I mean, that's what happens. That's what Satan speaks. And he wants to discourage you. Yeah, it was great, but you thought you found your fix. But we got to understand, Jesus is not a genie in a bottle that we just rub when we get into difficulty and we say the right prayer or do the right church service, and then those difficulties go away. So what happens if it gets worse? What happens if it gets much worse? Look at Job. Look at some of the people in scriptures. What happens if you're doing seemingly everything right and everything goes wrong? Well, let's take a look at what David does here. It says in the second part of verse 6, "But David strengthened himself in his God, in the Lord his God. And David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them? And he answered, pursue, for you shall surely overtake and surely rescue. So David set out, and the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the brook Besor, where they who were left behind stayed. And David pursued, he and 400 men, 200 stayed behind, who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor." So, David, first thing, there's difficulty going on. How am I going to do this now? I've come home, I've lost everything. It says that they are weeping to the point that they don't even have the energy to weep and to cry out anymore. They are at an absolute end of themselves. And then, key verse that you must highlight, if your neighbor doesn't have this highlighted in his Bible, just reach over, would you, and underline this verse. "But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God." Just underline that, and then look at them and say, "That's for you." "But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God." Those of you, especially many of you that we've been talking about discipleship and leading others and stuff a lot lately, tune in big time on this one, okay? When people go through difficulty, when things do get worse, or when tragedy comes, there is a way to provide counsel to people that puts all the responsibility of getting through something on that person. Please don't do that. To just say, like I used the verse already, or the saying already, where people say, the Lord will not make you go through anything that you can't handle. He's talking about sin, and he will always provide a temptation or a way out of that temptation when sin comes your way. He is not talking about difficulties. Sometimes he will purposefully allow more than we can handle so that we stop trying to rely on ourselves and we turn to him. And we have to be really careful, I believe, when we're counseling people who are going through difficulty to put across some sort of, just buck up, you can get through this. This is your chance to prove to everybody that you're a Christian. Or this is your chance to be a witness. Sometimes you just need to go, man, you need to turn to the Lord because the Lord is your strength. You don't have the strength to deal with this, and I don't have it either. I'd give it to you. That is very good biblical counsel. To say, turn to the Lord. And I love the personal nature of this, but David strengthened himself in the Lord, his God. He can't say, here's my family. He can't say, here's my home. He can't say, here's my land, but he's still saying, the Lord my God. That's good theology right there. That though everything may be gone, the Lord is my God. And that he would turn to the Lord in that place to strengthen himself. Now the question then is like, so how, what does that even mean? To strengthen ourselves in the Lord. How do we go about doing that? And there's not a step-by-step process on here's what David did to go and strengthen himself in the Lord. But there are some clues that are here both in David's writing here, or in Samuel's writing in 1 Samuel 30, or in the Psalms themselves. The first thing is you can recall the Lord's character. Okay, so we have not heard from David going to the Lord for a long time. It hasn't really come up. We don't see God talk, or David talking to God. Haven't seen it for a long time, actually, in Scripture. Now, it could have been that David saw what's going on and says, this is all happening because I turned away from God, and now I've got to get my act together so that I am put myself back in a position of favor with God, and then this stuff won't happen to me anymore. And that's not what happened. He doesn't try to clean himself up first. He doesn't go through a certain amount of penance before he returns to the Lord. He knows that the Lord is good. He knows. He writes about it in the Psalms. I look to the hills, for where does my help come from? He knows that God is good, that God is able, that God has thoughts towards him. He trusts in God's character, his very nature, that this is the place that I can go for help and be assured of it. The second thing is, you can recall his promises. God's made very specific promises to David. You will be king. There will be a kingdom. This kingdom is never going to end. He's made very specific promises to David. And he knows God's character, that God is good. He knows God is sovereign. God is strong. God's promises never fail. Not one word hits the ground. And God has made promises to me. And I may feel like I'm at an end to myself, but I know this. I know what God said. It hasn't happened yet, but I know it's coming. And so I can strengthen myself in those things. The promises in Scripture, even for us, those that say that the Lord has thoughts towards us of good and not evil to bring us a future and a hope. Even when we're in a place that we don't have hope, we don't see the future, we can go back to the nature of God, that he is good, that he is loving always, he is good always, that his promises always come to fruition. And then remind yourself of the very promises he has made. Though father and mother abandon you, I will never. And then the last thing is this. You can recall his presence. And this is the one we see most clearly in the text here. So David calls Abiathar the priest. Says, bring me the ephod, and brings the priest ahead. The priest was the mediator between God and man, their ability to go to the very presence of God, if you will, and to entreat of the Lord and inquire of the Lord. And here in the middle of this utter devastation where there's nothing around, everything is gone, he's lost everything, he remembers that he has access to the presence of God and says, go get the priest. And so too, when we're in difficulty, to just know he's there. We don't have to call a priest. You don't have to call Pastor Jeff. You don't have to go to a certain service, or you don't have to know that God is there. And then even go backwards, back into the promises again, that he is near the brokenhearted, that he understands our frames, that they are dust, that he pities us as a father pities a child, and that he's right there. That's how you strengthen yourself in the Lord. That is not David going, I can do this. I can do this, man. I need to toughen it up and I can do this. My men are watching me. I need to show that I have faith in God. This is David turning and saying, it's all on you, God. It is all on you. You are my deliverance. You are the king. You are my salvation. You are the joy of the Lord is my strength. And so David strengthens himself in the Lord. He doesn't strengthen himself for the Lord. It's different. And so this passage continues. Take a look at verse 11. So that we'll get back to this whole thing about 400 men and 200 men in a minute. Just pause on that one. So they found an Egyptian in the open country, and they brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate, and they gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. And David said to him, to whom do you belong? And where are you from? And he said, I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite. And my master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago. We had made a raid against Negeb of the Chethorites and against that which belongs to Judah and against the Negeb of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And David said to him, will you take me down to this band? And he said, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me to the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this band. This is awesome. This is so cool if you really think about it. So here's these guys. We don't know where to go. We don't know what to do. Remember something. David doesn't know for sure who did this at this point. Before he meets the Egyptian, they don't know who did this. There's no calling card left behind. There's none of that stuff. He's going, should we pursue? Will we overcome? He knows nothing. And then he runs across this just so happens, this Egyptian servant that just so happened to get really, really sick. And it just so happened that the Amalekites felt, this guy's sick, he's probably dying, he's going to do us no good anymore, let's just get rid of this guy. So they kick him to the curb, and just so happens they leave him behind as they move off with all of David's other possessions. And it just so happens David's army comes along. And they feed this guy, they give encouragement to him, they give nourishment to him, they let him kind of gain in his strength. Who knows how long that actually took? I think there's a powerful side note in this, and regards to how we treat those that have been rejected by the world around us, because here's a guy that the Amalekites looked at. He is worthless. He's weighing us down. He's going to do no good. Let's just move on and leave him behind. And yet this is the very man that's going to be result in the very downfall of the Amalekite people. Dale Ralph Davis, I believe, the pastor from back east, who said, only Amalekites think mustard seeds can't amount to anything. And it's so true. It's so true. You know, I was thinking about this today in terms of a lot of the abortion debates that are going on today. How so many people are saying they're just cells. They're just all of this kind of stuff. And who knows what kind of greatness God wants to do out of these that the world would want to cast aside and say we don't need them. They're holding us down. All those kinds of things. Who knows what the Lord would do? But that's a whole another sermon for another time. But here's this man that just happens to be there. And so we find another thing that we can take courage, take hope in, no matter how bad things get, is that God is still there working. When we talk about the sovereignty of God, this is what we're talking about. The providence of God, this is what we're talking about. There's no big theological bells and whistles saying, oh, look, God's here. This is what, it doesn't look miraculous. It looks somewhat ordinary. It's just one of those, it just so happened that all these things come together. It just so happened that this is the guy. So they come across him, and who are you from? He's with the Amalekites, and yeah, we just burned Ziklag. Really? Can you take us to those guys? Look, as long as you don't leave me with them and don't kill me, I will take you. It just so happens. And there's another thing I want to point out in this. The sovereignty and the providence of God in this, it's not just like, oh, that's cool that happened. Like, now that'll help us along the way. Like, it's some sort of, I don't know, shortcut. Like, there was no chance that they recover or that they find. There's no chance apart from God working in this scenario. They don't find this guy. Who knows? And yet God intervenes. And so, verse 16, when he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David struck them down from twilight until evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. Now, believe it or not, someone actually, I read, was protesting David's action here, because they were saying, look, the people didn't kill David's people, and now David's turned around and killing everyone. Well, when captives are taken like that in these Far Eastern or ancient Middle Eastern cultures like that, they're brought for one reason. They're going to be sold into slavery. It's a horrific life that's ahead for these people. So David comes in and he catches all these people and he kills them. And I don't know about you, but if a kidnapper came and took your kid, I better not say what I would do. That'll get me in trouble. So never mind. Let's just move on. So David struck them down from twilight until evening of the next day. And not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. And David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken. And David rescued his two wives, and nothing was missing, whether small or great, or sons or daughters, or spoil, or anything that had been taken. David brought back all. Read that last part together with me. David brought back how much? All. These two verses go through a lot of detail to point out, by the way, he got everything. Everything. A couple of years ago, I was fly fishing with a friend of mine, Aaron Havivian. You guys know who leads worship here. And a friend of mine named Mike. Mike is a fly fishing guide for steelhead on the Rogue River. And I'd wanted to take Aaron out for a long time. So I call up my friend. Can you do a drift boat trip with us? Yeah, come on out. So we go out there and we drifted down the Rogue River. And I caught fish and Aaron didn't. So that was awesome. And then we have a competition thing going. So he had his chances. But anyway, so we get out of the boat and it's the end of the day. And we unpack all the stuff there at the boat ramp, and we tie up the boat, and we do all this stuff, and we're pulling Mike's boat with my car, and we're driving back into town. And from the Shady Cove boat ramp, we get to, White City maybe, on our way back into Medford, and Mike just screams. The guide, he's like, oh no, and he's like freaking out. What is wrong with you? And he goes, I left my rods and my camera at the boat ramp. Now, I don't know if you know much about how the high-end fly fishing world, it ain't cheap for these guys that are guides. I mean, his reels that he had are like $600 per reel, and there's like four of them. The rods are probably $500 to $700, depending on what they are. It's ridiculous what some of these guys pay for this stuff. And he's got all that stuff, plus a high-end digital camera with the lens is like that long and the whole deal. There are thousands and thousands of dollars worth of stuff in Shady Cove in prime season just sitting at the boat ramp. And he is freaking out. So I'm like, all right, look, we'll turn around, let's go. So we shoot a U-turn in White City, and we're headed back out towards Shady Cove. And I got a friend of mine who's also a guide who's on the river all the time, and I knew he'd be in that area, so I'm calling him up. Hey, can you run over to the boat ramp and see if that stuff's there? You'll get there way before we do. He's like, yeah, I'm on it. So we're driving, and we're headed up that way. And as we get to, like, somewhere in the Eagle Point area, you know how it is, guys. When you're in a hurry, what always happens? Some slow dang car pulls out in front of you, and they're just on a Sunday drive. Oh, Southern Oregon's beautiful. You know, just that kind of drive. And you're like, I have to get somewhere. There's a couple of police officers in here. I was not speeding. I shouldn't say that. I just lied in church. Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry. So we're like flying up through there, and this car pulls out in front, and we're like, come on, and no passing zones anywhere. And on the back, on the personalized license tag on the car, no kidding, 1 Sam 30. And I'm looking at that, and Aaron's in the back seat. I'm like, hey, Aaron, I got a Bible back there. Can you remember anything in 1 Samuel 30 that might give us some hope in this situation? He's like, all right, I'll look. So we're still driving. The car's right there the whole time. We're following. I can't remember the story in there, and Aaron couldn't either. And so he looks it up, and he's really quiet. And then I'm like, so did you find anything? And he goes, well, I think so, but I was going to wait till we got there to say anything. Because he's like afraid to say anything. And I'm like, so what? Tell me the story. And And he tells us, this is a story, and he reads that, "Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought back all." And no joke, I know this is like all weird. I'm not that guy, but this is, that happened, right? Right after he finishes that verse, the car's turn signal comes on, and he turns off to the right. We speed up, and we go on into Shady Cove and pull up to the boat ramp, and there's my buddy Dave Roberts standing there with all the fly fishing stuff and the camera and everything just standing there. Now, was God working in that? I think so. Maybe just for the sake of being able to encourage people with that kind of story. Maybe to minister to Mike's heart, who was going through some stuff, wanted to hear from the Lord in that way. Does God really come down and intervene in the lives of people? I mean, is he really that great of a God that he cares if you lost your camera? Yes. Does he care that your investment tanked and you lost thousands? Yes. Well, then why doesn't he just always give us back everything? Well, he does give you always back everything when it is for your good that you have it. The scriptures say he will not withhold any good thing from you. But let me assure you, he works. He is moving. He is 100% sovereign and active and working in the world around us and in your lives. And a lot of times it's through the small, little, seemingly insignificant. It might be the guy that everyone else would walk by and see as nothing. And that might be the guy that God's put in your path because he wants to minister to your heart, minister to your soul, or save you. He is absolutely active. So David goes and he recovers everything. David also captured flocks and herds. Didn't just restore what he had, but look at this. David also captured flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before him and said, "This is David's spoil." And then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the brook Besor. And they went out to meet David and the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. Now check this out. Celebration's going on. We got all the stuff back. Everybody's reuniting with their families. This is a big event, right? This is a big deal what's going on right here. Imagine how much you know, Mike, when he finds his fly rods are still there. He's like, oh, imagine if it's your kids, right? So this is what's going on here. And then it says, verse 22, "Then all the wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, 'Because they didn't go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we've recovered, except that each man may lead away his wife and children and depart.'" They didn't come fight, so all this extra stuff we got, they don't get any of that. They just get their wives and kids back. Which is very gracious of you to let them have their wives and kids back. But they don't get anything else other than that. They didn't fight. They don't get it. They stayed back. They were too tired. They don't get anything. And look what David says. "But David said, 'You shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike.' And he made it a statute and a rule from Israel from that day forward unto this day." Now, I want you to pay real close attention to what's going on with David right here. David says very clearly, this is what, verse 23, what the Lord has given us. To David, they don't have plunder, you understand. They don't have rewards from battle. They have gifts from God. That's what they have. David fully understands the reason that they are successful in this battle is not because they're awesome, it's because God's awesome. The reason they found the enemy is not because they're awesome, because God's awesome. The reason they have all these things is not because they have pulled their sleeves up and gone to work and earned some big take, but because God has chosen to bless them and has poured out more than even what they lost. He's given them even extra on top of that. You see, David doesn't just have some sort of theological concept of grace, but his understanding of the grace and goodness of God has become his worldview. So therefore, when he looks at this, he doesn't have to say, look, this is what we earned. This is what God has given. And he's even going to the standpoint of saying, the guy that stayed back by the baggage has just as much right to the grace of God as we who went and fought on the front lines. That is a major worldview adjustment from what the people are doing right here. It is completely different. But this is David's understanding that this is the Lord that has done this work. And when you have this sort of understanding, when you move away from this self-focused, I earned it, I did it, I worked hard, I gained this, when you move away from that aspect and you move towards this is what the Lord has given me, I mean, that is a major path to generosity. When we focus more on what we deserve and what we've earned and what others didn't do for that, you're moving into legalism, not into grace. And this is a great example here between works and grace. Because the works people are saying, we earned it. And we're impressed with what we have done. And they didn't do it, so they don't deserve any of that. But grace says it is on the goodness of God that we have anything, that we even have our families back, much less the other rewards that are given. And so grace, instead of being so caught up in their own accomplishments and their own possessions and their own things, is much more free to just invite others into the celebration, to invite others into what God is doing, and to just enjoy and grow in this kingdom, this party that's going on right here among these people. But it's not just a theology for David. It informs his decisions. It's part of his life. And it goes on as we can finish here, verse 26. When David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, here's a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. It was for those in Bethel, in Ramoth of Negeb, in Jatir, in Aror, in Siphmoth, in Eshtemoah, in Rakal, in the cities of the Jehar-Mil. I practice that one all day. Jerusalem, something, whatever. In the cities of the Kenites, in Horma, in Bor Ashan, in Aphek, in Hebron, for all the places where David and his men have roamed. So here's what he does. He doesn't just include everyone else in all the spoil, but then he even takes some of the spoil and he's sending it to the other kingdoms in the area that had been victims of the plundering that the Amalekite people had been doing. Now, in one hand, that is incredibly gracious what he's doing there. It's also pretty shrewd, because this is the kind of thing that is going to gain him friendships and influences that will help lead to his kingdom and his kingship in Judah. And so even right there, this idea of I'm going to bless others and it paves the way for the king to rule in the territory, the same too for us. Like the opportunity to bless and love and share and with others is more than just some sort of possessions thing. We are attempting, our desire is to make way for the king in the hearts and minds of people all around us all the time. And look how he describes it in verse 26, and we'll be all done. He doesn't say, here's a present for you from the kingdom treasury. Here's a present for you from my victory and all the stuff that I've got. But he says, here is a present for you from the spoil of who? The enemies of the Lord. Like David knows this is way bigger than just him. This is not just an issue of David versus the Amalekites. This is an issue of we live in a world that is divided with a genuine, real, spiritual battle that goes on. It is between God and Satan. It's way more than us. And so going back to even this very issue of suffering, we need to understand that when you choose to follow Jesus, you've just made yourself, as Jesus would tell us himself, we've become enemies of the world that's there. And we've heard it before, right? War is hell. And so we ought not be surprised when here we are inside of a kingdom that has penetrated, if you will, enemy lines in the world that we live right now. When we follow Jesus, you better believe things are going to be difficult. But what does Jesus say? He says, in this world you will have trouble, but take hope, I have overcome the world. So God has, just as David was able to encourage himself in the Lord, strengthen himself in the Lord, remember the promises that God has made that they are going to come to fruition. We have a king that says, just take hope in me. And he says, I write these things that you may have peace in me, is what Jesus says. In the world you will have trouble, but take hope for I have overcome the world. It's going to be hard. Tomorrow might be worse than today. Even though you went to church, tomorrow might be worse than today. You might even get up and pray tomorrow, and it might be way worse. But I encourage you, strengthen yourself in the Lord and know it's bad because we're in a fight. There is a battle for the hearts and souls of people and for the very world that we walk on going around, but take hope in the fact that you serve the God who has already won. And the real King is coming. Take hope in that. Amen? Amen. I'm going to cut you guys loose. Let's stand.